coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I'm not lighting pipe. I'm talking about poetry.
Why does poetry matter?
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion.
Is poetry valuable because it does something for us?
Can a poem of loss help us to grieve?
Can a poem of sadness help us feel seen?
When people talk about the audience for poetry and is it diminishing and is poetry endangered, seems meaningless to me because the audience for poetry in my imagination is one person.
Our guest is Nobel Prize-winning poet Louise Glick.
They require the reader. They're spoken to someone.
If the powerful play goes on, then you may contribute a verse.
Why poetry matters.
What will your verse be?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Is poetry just a fun pastime?
Or can it change our lives?
Can poems help us to connect, think, and feel?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about why poetry matters.
I'm so excited to talk about this, Ray. I think poetry matters enormously, and the more we all have of it in our lives, the better off we are.
I love poetry, but I'm not sure it matters enormously. I'm with Marianne Moore. You know, she was a brilliant poet, but even she admitted that there are things that are important beyond all this fiddle. Like, there's war, famine, climate change. It's hard to see poetry being that life or death.
Yeah, but that's only half the quote, Ray. The other half is, there is in it, after all, a place for the genuine. And lots of people see poetry that way, as a place to gain genuine wisdom.
I don't know about wisdom, Josh. You like Baudelaire, right? Mm-hmm. And he even says that truth has nothing to do with song. Look, I can say anything I want in rhyming couplets. It doesn't have to be true. Rat-a-tat-tat, the earth is flat. See?
That's a good example. And yeah, okay, poems don't have to be true, but you know, a lot of them are filled with interesting ideas. Like, take one of the earliest Greek philosophers, Parmenides. He wrote his entire treatise in dactylic hexameter. It wasn't the greatest poem ever, but it was still a philosophical one.
Yeah, okay, but why do you need a poem to do any of that? He could have just written it all in prose. It probably would have been a lot clearer, too.
Clearer, sure, but less memorable. Poetry has a way of sticking in your head.
I don't know if that's such a great thing, though. What if you write a really catchy poem and it just says something completely false? Maybe it's going to stick in people's heads and actually convince them to believe the wrong thing.
Yeah, but when poems get it right about the world, they can do things no piece of prose ever could. Take Mary Oliver's beautiful line, "I think this is the prettiest world, so long as you don't mind a little dying." Isn't that great? I mean, that's not just true. It's important, and the poetry makes you feel that importance.
Yeah, it is great. It's a great line, but it's not because it tells us anything we didn't already know. What's great about it is that it gives us a new vocabulary for talking about shared human experiences, like knowing that everything dies.
I totally agree. Poems give us words for the things we think and feel, or half think and half feel. Beautiful words, powerful words, so we can finally take possession of them.
Exactly. Plus, poems can take us into the mind of another person. It's like you're right inside their head, thinking their thoughts, feeling their feelings. Simone de Beauvoir says that's the miracle of art.
Yeah, that's something we could definitely both agree on, Ray.
And not only that, but they give us these great experiences. Like, think of the joy you get from reading Sappho, or Langston Hughes, or Emily Dickinson.
Well, okay, there's definitely a lot of joy in those poems, but what about things like Philip Larkin's Obad, one of the most devastating poems ever written about human mortality? I mean, when I read that poem, I'm not exactly singing and dancing.
Yeah, but poems don't need to be upbeat to create a valuable experience. A sad poem can make you feel less alone because you know that a brilliant mind has felt exactly the same things as you. They can give form to chaos. They can turn inarticulate suffering into beautiful speech, And, you know, they can help you feel your feelings, whether those feelings are good feelings or bad ones.
But here's what I don't understand. I mean, if my feelings are painful ones, why would I want to feel them more intensely?
Well, because suffering is part of a human life. Mary Oliver was right about that. Instead of pushing our suffering down or running away from it, we just have to feel it. And there's nothing like poetry for helping us to do that.
I totally agree. But enough about what we think. I can't wait to hear what our guest thinks. We have the great honor today of being joined by Louise Glick, winner of the 2020 Nobel Prize in Literature.
And we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to check in with two poets from the San Francisco Bay Area to ask why poetry matters to them. She files this report.
Hola, my name is Josiah Luis Alderete, Pocho poet and proud Spanglish speaker. As a brown person in these Estados Unidos, as a brown person living here in San Francisco, poetry matters because for us, it's not only a work of art. It's not only a way to appreciate and express beauty. It's also a way to remember things. Poetry's memoria, poetry's history. I know that I have personally learned a lot of my Chicano history, my Chicanx history, through poetry, through other poets that sort of like explained Chicanismo to me or explained Latinidad to me, you know, explained what the Mission District used to be, explained what Los Angeles used to be. Poetry for me is like a biological function. So if I didn't write it, it would, I am not exaggerating when I say I would probably die. The poem isn't titled, so it's untitled. The rules for Español, en el carro or en la casa. The rules for Spanglish, near the front door or on certain playgrounds. The rules for English, near the Sizzler salad bar or whenever we talk about history. The rules for Nahua that I hear in my dreams, pues no me acuerdo. You see, my accent, it goes way, way back, and it was not formed by the neighborhood I grew up in or the place that mi familia is from. Nah, you see, my accent has been formed by all those things about ourselves that were not taught to us, by all those things that our ancestors were not allowed to say. You see, my accent has been formed by the forced, violent migration of mi gente, by the mystical, milagroso migration of mi gente.
My name is Janae Darden. I'm originally from Oakland, California, and I'm a journalist and a poet. And my book is When a Purple Rose Blooms. Maya Angelou, she used to say, words are things, and words have energy. And so words are very powerful, and definitely poetry matters. You know, you can really go outside the boundaries, depending on what kind of poet you are. Some poets may say there's rules, some poets may say there aren't rules, or there aren't very many rules. And so you can really be creative in how you express yourself and just the way it reaches people. And it does not even have to reach people when it comes to something serious. Just pulling out the joy in people and the laughter. And so poetry makes us laugh, it makes us think. It definitely matters. It speaks to the human spirit. So this is called Self-Esteem. Men believe in her since she entered the world. Her daddy split right after the doctor said, "It's a girl." Her first boyfriend left her for Alexis. Her second boyfriend left her for Texas. Her third boyfriend left her for Travis. Her fiancé left her for the bottle and the nice girl on 85th with a blonde weave. All she knew about men were they lie, they leave. And their hearts had a short attention span for her love. "What's wrong with me?" she cried to her friends. "What's wrong with me?" "Girl," they say, "you just need some self-esteem." "Huh? Self-esteem? Where do you get that?" she asked. "Is it something you buy off the rack? Do they sell it at Big Lots next to discounted baby fat?" Self-esteem. Does it come in a lotion bottle? Or a jar like beauty cream? Has Oprah given it away in her favorite things? Can I get it at the Slauson Swap Meet or Durant Square? Is it easy to put on like a clip in my hair? Hold up. Does it come with my Obamacare? Do I eat it? Do I wear it? Do I hang it on the wall? Is it available year-round? Winter, spring, summer, fall? Is it free? Do I have to pay? Don't play. Does it fall from the sky or grow from the ground? Maybe mine is in some lost and found. Is it something I can hold? Will it make me feel good? Do they make it for rich girls and us girls in the hood? Is there a commercial for it, a jingle, a song? Can I order it from Amazon? Get some self-esteem. You make it seem easy, she said to her friends. You make it sound like it's the answer, without a doubt. But how is self-esteem the key in a world that constantly tries to lock Black women out? Now, this is where the poem ends, because when looking for self-esteem, where does one begin?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Those are some beautiful thoughts about poetry and some beautiful poems. Thanks so much for that great report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about why poetry matters.
We're joined now by poet Louise Glick. She's the winner of the 2020 Nobel Prize in Literature, and she's published many collections of poems, as well as volumes of essays about poetry, like Proofs and Theories. Louise, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Louise, one of my favorite essays of yours talks about what poetry meant to you as a child. So when did you first start reading poetry, and what was that experience like for you?
Transforming, obviously. I started reading poetry very early. I read early. And I've told this story so many times, I'm embarrassed. My grandmother, who was not a particular reader, happened to have in the house, her house, a few anthologies, including one, a book of Shakespeare's songs, and one, some sort of anthology in which Blake appeared. And I remember the song from Cymbeline, Fear No More the Heat of the Sun, and Blake's Little Black Boy, about which I've written recently. And the Shakespeare, I understood none of the words, but I heard the tone, even as a small child. And I was stirred.
Yeah.
That makes me sort of think about the value of poetry. So earlier, Josh was saying it gets at important truths, and I thought there was probably something else that was going on. What do you think?
Yes, I do. I think it reformulates the things that we know so that we feel them freshly.
That sounds close to something one sometimes hears about giving words to thoughts and feelings that people might otherwise not have words for.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think that the finding of such words is ultimately hugely consoling and also provocative.
So why consoling?
Because it means if you hear it, you're not alone with it.
Mm.
So it's like my fantasy of dying in an airplane crash, which always seems to me very congenial as a way to die because you're not dying alone. So there isn't that sense that you've been chosen for exile. Everybody with you is dying. And in a way, everybody with you is dying. But on the airplane, it's more vigorously true.
So this also makes me wonder about poems that are about particular experiences. So one of the things that I appreciate about poetry sometimes is that it gives me a window into an experience I haven't had. So I was just reading Cameron Awkward Rich's poem After Lucille Clifton, which is about the figure of cockroaches and is using the figure of cockroaches to talk about Blackness and Black experience, which is not my experience in the U.S., but I sort of find that really valuable, and I find it a really beautiful poem. And I wonder how you see poetry connecting people with different experiences.
Well, they do. It does. And it does because even if you haven't had, and this goes back to the definition of truth, which is a word tossed around and not defined. But the experience, the literal factual experience, you haven't had, but the poem gives you a sense of what that experience is analogous to in your experience. So there is a sense of the enlargement of the spirit to include the parallel but different set of feelings and narrative experience.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about poetry with Nobel Prize winner Louise Glick.
Are you a fan of poetry? How does it make you think and feel? Does it help you notice things you'd never noticed before?
Spending your time amid rhythm and rhyme, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Passions just like mine. They were born and then they lived and then they died. Seems so unfair, I want to cry. Are you Team Yeats or Team Wild? I'm Josh Landy and I'm Team Yeats. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs and I'm Team Wild. Today, we're thinking about poetry with Louise Glick, winner of the 2020 Nobel Prize in Literature and author of American Originality.
We're pre-recording this episode, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls today, but you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Louise, in one of your essays, you say that you like poems where questions outnumber answers. Can you tell us more about what that means?
That's a good question. well, it seems a pithy little statement. I think I want poems that complicate and question my thought, not that affirm positions. So poems that answer too many questions seem dogmatic and limited. And I want to interact more vigorously. So I like questions.
So at the risk of sounding a little self-indulgent, I have an anecdote that has really stuck in my head, where I wrote a poem that was just a series of questions. And I showed it to one of my friends. And he wrote back with his answer to each question and asked if he had got it right. And that seemed exactly wrong to me. It wasn't what I wanted.
Oh, I don't blame you.
So what do you want your reader to do in a, you know, when these questions are posed?
I don't care. I want them to feel something. If they feel nothing, then that would be either a judgment on the poem or a judgment on the reader. And if you're the poet, you always fear that it's the former.
So that's interesting because that moves us out of the realm of thought into the realm of feeling. And you've written beautifully about the kinds of feelings that poems can evoke in the good cases in readers, including not just what we were talking about earlier, this sense of companionship, where we're not alone anymore. But also intimacy. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because you've written so wonderfully about certain poets, not all poets, who create that special bond with us.
My preference, my bias is for poems that seem essentially collaborative with the reader, so that they require the reader. They're spoken to someone. Let us go then, you and I. It's an invitation, and it's an invitation spoken to the reader, and I feel my presence required. I like Emily Dickinson. She's an example of this. And most poets do it to some extent or other, but not all. And this is something I prize, this sense of only you. And when people talk about the audience for poetry and is it diminishing and is poetry endangered, seems meaningless to me because the audience for poetry in my imagination is one person. And it can be a sequential person. It doesn't have to be a stadium full of people. It can be one person and then 20 years later, another person.
I'm curious also about cases where I don't feel like I'm the central audience for a poem, and I either appreciate it and sort of feel like I'm listening in on something, or in some cases, I kind of get like a little mad at the poet because I think that they're doing something they shouldn't be. So I think that like some poets who have like really sexist stuff to say, like I get mad at Larkin for this reason sometime, where I'm like, you're not talking to me and you're not talking to like a viewpoint I want to inhabit, and I don't like that. How do I sort of negotiate with that? Is it just like not every poem is going to speak to every reader?
Yes. Not every poem is going to speak to every reader. But I don't think poems are necessarily written for a a particular audience. They're written for who needs to hear them, and they're written as a sort of testament by the writer who is trying to understand his or her experience.
But maybe we could come back to the kind of poem where you feel we're really invited in, and we're really, you know, Emily Dickinson's talking to me.
Yeah.
And Blake's talking to me, and Eliot's talking to me, and not only are they talking to me, but they somehow the poem needs me. Can you say a little bit more about that experience and why you find that so valuable?
I think I find it valuable because I find it humanly encouraging, but also encouraging to me as an artist. If I'm essential to this great poem, then perhaps I could do something parallel. So there's a sense that the form is within my reach.
And is that how it felt to you as a child, reading reading the Shakespeare, that where you could just feel the tone?
Yes. I felt ill at ease in the world as a child. And I was growing up in an upper middle class suburb on Long Island, and I often thought questions that you could reformulate as, where are my people? And when I read poems, I thought, that's where they are. These are the people I want to talk to. And my fantasy when I was writing from the beginning was that Yeats would come down from heaven and say, very well done, Louise. And I still hope for that.
The poets who you mentioned as really speaking to you, sometimes through sound rather than through sense first, seems like they use a lot of meter and rhyme. And I wonder if that's a way of connecting with another person, even when the sense is not, and how you think about sound in your poetry.
Not that way. And I think we're talking there about the historical period and the conventions of the time. I like poems that sound like a human being speaking. I think that's a more accurate way of describing what I respond to. And more often than not, because of the speech to which I'm used, I prefer poems that don't rhyme because they sound more like a human.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about why poetry matters with Nobel laureate Louise Glück. So, Louise, I want to read you a couple of comments that we got from listeners on our website. Tim in
Already?
Seattle.
Already? You have comments?
Uh-huh. You're a popular guest. So Tim in Seattle says, our mental experience of life is poetry. So I think it's a beautiful line. And Paul suggests, verse allows us to wander into the abstract recesses of consciousness, but the images are not readily accessible to everyone. That's interesting. So is that something?
Are they talking to me particularly?
They're talking about poetry.
They both talk very well.
I think so too. So that makes me wonder, do you mind if when you're writing your beautiful and often difficult poems? And I mean that in a good way.
I took it that way.
Yes. I wouldn't take Paul's line, the images are not readily accessible to everyone, as in any way a criticism. That might actually be a strength.
I think if you write an image deliberately to exile the reader, that's a problem. But if the poem isn't immediately intelligible at its every level, that's not a problem. As long as the poem haunts. But there will be readers who aren't moved by any piece of work, always.
How do you judge for yourself when a poem you've written is successful? Is it like, if you get one person coming up to you and telling you that it moved them, is that the mark? Does it do something internally to you?
Not that, no. I mean, that's sometimes moving and touching and humanly, but it has nothing to do with the poem. I show my work to people who are demanding readers and who will make sure that the poem is as good as it can possibly be. And if it never gets to being very good, then that poem will not be visible to the world. I'm not prolific. I've lived a long time. So I have a lot of work, but not because I write often. But I trust these readers. And every once in a while I write something about which I'm immediately and absolutely confident, and my confidence will not be shaken. But often I write something that departs from existing modes or tones, and I really can't tell whether it's terrible or wonderful, and I need my readers for that.
So as one of your readers, I just want to talk briefly about one of my favorite, you know that this is one of my favorite poems of yours, Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about that poem is something we were talking about earlier, the fact that it's asking questions rather than giving answers. Yeah. And boy, does it stay with you. Does it gnaw at you? Yeah. Right? A poem where it asks this incredible question, whether it's better to interact with a real life human being or whether to have an image of them in your head. That, to me, is a sign of extraordinary success that even today, I don't know how long it is since I've had this poem with me.
A long time.
A long time. Does that ring true for you, that's at least one mark of a successful poem, that someone's still chewing on it and trying to think about this important and difficult question?
I can't think of a better ambition for a poem to have.
Is there something like that for you? Is there a poem or a set of poems out there by other people that stay with you in that way?
Oh, Lord. Of course. Yeah. And they're somehow deeply mysterious in ways that seem to be acknowledging a fundamental mystery, unanswerable question. And they haunt, they resonate. I think not of a poem, but a novel, Wuthering Heights, which I've read many, many times. And each time I read it, I think the center of the story is a different person. And I think because I think the center is different humanly, the story becomes different. Wuthering Heights has been to me at least four different books at different times in my life. It's not recent enough for me to expand on that, fortunately for the show.
So we have another comment from our website from Daniel, who writes, "Poets historically can get away with criticizing tyrants, while political opponents can't." Do you have comments on that?
Oh, poetry has no trouble criticizing tyrants, but poetry is not engaged with tyrants, negotiating with tyrants. So we're in a different position. Freer.
Right. But it makes me wonder, I mean, obviously there's poetry that's directly political, satirical, and so on. But I wonder about things that are trying to make change more indirectly. So something like, for example, the poetry of Aimé Césaire, who's a surrealist poet who's sort of trying to tackle racism in this fascinating indirect way by essentially changing the structure of thought. Mm-hmm. Right, so you take something that I think Dickinson's doing, and I think you're doing, by the way, in some of your poems, which is, you know, reach inside the mind of the reader and productively chip away at people's confident certainties and categories so that we can move the pieces around. In the case of someone like Césaire, it seems like there's a political hope behind that. Does that seem like a reasonable hope, or does that seem a little fantastical to you?
You mean reasonable in the sense that it could have an effect in the world?
Yes.
I imagine it could, because it could influence someone who lived a more active and involved life.
I do have a kind of a cool example of somebody I'm proud to know. We should put references in the show notes, but I have a friend who is actually banned from reading one of his poems out loud in Singapore, of which the first line was, "Come on, straight boy, and make gay love with me," which I feel like that's a kind of interesting example of both like a very funny poem and also a political poem.
So Ray, is your thought that that kind of poetry could actually have a political impact?
Yeah, I think it had enough of a political impact on like the Singaporean government that they were scared of it.
That's so interesting. Louise, I want to come back to something else as well about Ray's thought earlier of getting inside the mind of another person. I mean, it connects to what we're talking about, but maybe less indirectly. Your poetry very often puts an interesting sort of barrier between us and you, in the sense that you often write in the persona of a character.
Yeah.
Sometimes a flower, sometimes a man, and so on and so on. Do you think there's any particular advantage on the one hand to speaking as oneself, or on the other hand to speaking in the guise of a character?
I'm always speaking as myself.
So even when you're a flower, so
to
speak.
Yeah. The flowers just have human feelings. So the self is not a monolith. The self is a prism. We have lots of selves. And you don't want to choose one and have it rigidly there, dead center of every poem. That will be really tiresome. And your poems will be predictable. And I want my poems to be surprising insofar as it can be managed.
That's so interesting. Because in one of your essays, and maybe it's unfair of me to quote this at you, but I really liked it. You say, writing is not a decanting of a personality.
Oh, yeah.
So is that compatible with this thought? I mean, is the thought, well, it's still the poet speaking, but it's somehow refracted?
It's exactly compatible with the thought.
Okay.
And it was thought by the same person, so it's not surprising.
That could be a different aspect of you.
That's right. Well, they agree, those two aspects.
So how does that work? So it's not a decanting of personality, but it's still an expression of in some way, or an indirect expression.
Not personality.
Okay.
Dilemmas. I think if you read more than one poem by a poet, and when I say a poet, I mean a poet of some substance and interest, continuous interest, you'll begin to get a sense of the personality of that writer and the manners, the various ways the voice can make itself heard. So you understand reading many poems, but you explore a range of approaches, ideally.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the power of poetry with Nobel laureate Louise Glick.
Do you write poetry? What do you want your poetry to do? How would you like people to respond to it?
Writing a line that sends chills down your spine.
Writing a line that is finer than wine.
Writing a line that won't die on the vine. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. If someone hands you a book of 13th century poems, do the words ring true? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Nobel Prize-winning poet Louise Glick, and we're thinking about why poetry matters.
So Louise, you don't just write poetry, you also teach it, and I happen to know you do so extremely well. So what's the best piece of advice that you have for aspiring writers?
Cultivate patience.
Say more.
I couldn't say less, could I? I think poets are encouraged often in habits of diligence and application, as though will were the way that poems were written. But it seems to me that that is not the case. There's a certain kind of applied effort that makes sense once a poem has manifested itself. But there's a lot of waiting for the thing to come right. And there's a lot of waiting sometimes even to begin. And you have to be able to do that. If you want your work to evolve and change, you have to bear with periods of silence or wretched writing. And you have to tell yourself the truth about these things. If the poems are terrible, the poems are terrible. But you have to wait it out, and that's very hard. And it continues to be very hard, no matter how experienced a writer you are.
Yeah, it's been a real relief to me in reading your essays to learn that you also have had writer's block. Is there anything to do besides wait? Because it's really frustrating.
I don't call it writer's block, because writer's block assumes that there would be ongoing fluency. If what you want is epiphany, you don't get epiphany daily. And if that's what you wish your poems to achieve, you have to wait. And yes, it's painful, but then when it ends, it's euphoric. There may be other ways for other people. I talk about my own habits and my own dilemmas.
Thinking of euphoria, you say one of the most beautiful characterizations that I've read of the power of the emotive power of poetry in one of your essays, you say pre-existing anguish in being given form is externalized, and in being externalized, it's transformed into its opposite, into euphoria. That's just fantastic. I want to know if I'm getting you right. Is the thought that just the fact of putting sorrow into form, it doesn't have to be rhyme, of course, but some kind of lyrical form gives us a sort of control over it, makes it, I don't know, not necessarily beautiful, but somehow manageable?
That, and it's also transformed, because you take the smearing chaos of misery, you make a shape for it, and you've transformed it into something that has meaning. Mm. And I think this is invariably true. I think if you can do that thing, you change your feeling about misfortune. It's happened to me repeatedly.
Yeah, me too. You know, I sometimes say to my students, you know, you don't want your life to be a tragedy, but you'd rather a tragedy than just a mess.
Yeah.
Right? Just a painful mess.
Yeah.
At least it's tragic. At least it has form. You talk about rescuing the reader from a darkness without shape.
Yeah.
At least you have shape. And, of course, companionship.
Yeah.
So that seems like a wonderful alchemy that poetry can produce.
But your feeling has also changed about original experiences. I'll tell a quick anecdote. About 20 years ago, I had a very, very bad whiplash injury and excruciating neck pain that went on for years. And during that time, I managed to teach, but I wrote very little. And my life was just dominated by pain. And then gradually, the pain diminished somewhat enough so that I began to write. And I wrote one of the best books I've ever written in a very short period. Well, two very short periods separated by 2 years. And I realized that the book owed everything to the agony of that whiplash, but my attitude toward the pain was changed because it had given me this thing that was a triumph. So how could I hate it? If I'd had no pain, I would have had no book. It isn't always true that pain produces great work, but I now feel a kind of gratitude for that pain because of what came out of it. So that's a terrifically useful human thing that making art can do. Rarely, but sometimes.
It sounds like Nietzschean wisdom, right? That you can, in certain circumstances in your life, you can do something that essentially changes the narrative. And by changing the narrative, it retroactively changes the significance of an earlier event. So that whiplash wasn't just pain, physical suffering, long recuperation. that Whiplash now is the origin of these two books of great poetry.
Well, it was one book separated by two periods of composition.
Well, but, yes, still, one great book of poetry.
It turned out to be a muse, or it put me in possession of tones I hadn't had before, and a kind of amplitude I hadn't had. So I was grateful.
Yeah.
So, Louise, I wanted to ask you also about sort of reading and responding to other people's poetry. So I know that one sort of big poetry teaching tool is like the writing workshop, where everybody writes a critique. Do you have thoughts about what makes that useful, or is it useful, or when is it useful?
I think if someone is receptive, it's always useful. To hear an account of what you've done by a reader who's sensitive and not too rigid, a reader who's responsive to multiple approaches and tones. I think if you hear what that person makes week after week after week of individual poems, you begin to understand what it is that you're doing. And also, if that person is able to not simply diagnose and opine, but suggest alternatives which would allow for revision. So if you enter a poem and you say, why don't you try changing the syntax here, because the poem is getting a little tedious with all these declaratives. That might be, in a particular poem, a godsend. So you're not just giving mirroring the poem, you're also offering ideas about strategy.
And it sounds like for you there's not necessarily a right answer about how structured something should be. You know, rhyme could work in some cases, doesn't have to be there. It needs to have a shape. Does that imply anything? Does it imply syntax? Does it imply?
No. And in fact, the really exciting work in a class is the work that shows you something about shape that you didn't understand. Huh. Some student will write a brilliant piece of work, and it's often undergraduates, because they're especially undergraduates at schools that collect brilliant minds. They're much more flexible. They're not grooming themselves for public life. They're ready to change, and they do thrilling things sometimes.
We were talking earlier about poetry that consoles. Mm. But some of my favorite poetry is poetry that devastates, that leaves me crying. It leaves me feeling worse than before. But I don't hold that against it. I think that's a wonderful thing that poetry can do. But why? What's so great about that?
Catharsis. Mm. But also the sense of being reunited with your own strong feelings, so that the dull tedium of the world is transformed to something more dramatic and terrible briefly. But at least its importance is dignified.
Louise, I'm wondering if you have a favorite poem that you'd like to mention for our listeners, and say maybe why it's your favorite.
I don't have a favorite poem, no.
But do you is there among the poets of intimacy that you mentioned, Keats, Eliot, Dickinson, Blake, what would be one that people, a poem that people could start with to get them into this mood of intimacy with a poet who's talking just to you?
Well, the poem that I would name, I've gotten in a lot of trouble talking about, because it's Blake's Little Black Boy, and I'm not black, and he wasn't black, but of course he was an abolitionist, but I think that poem is a miracle, and as deeply affecting and subtle as any poem I can name, and heartbreaking. And a real attack on racist England.
Yeah.
And it Josh.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I'm just because I'm English. Yeah, it doesn't mean I stand behind the actions of my predecessors.
Yeah.
But thank you, Louise. That's a lovely note of great hope for the power of poetry to end on. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Our guest has been Louise Glick, winner of the 2020 Nobel Prize in Literature and author of American Originality, Essays on Poetry. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I'm thinking that one silver lining of this pandemic is that it has resulted in a lot more poetry being online, and that I've really been enjoying some of that in the last couple of years. So there have always been sort of online poetry magazines since before the pandemic, like Poetry Magazine has a lot online. Rattle, I love. Lived in Australia for a while, so I really enjoy Cordite. But also there have been sort of more online performances since the start of the pandemic. So Headmistress Press had this great series called The Collectibles, which you can still get on YouTube recordings. I think they've stopped recording new ones, but you can still get the old ones. And the Queensland Poetry Festival, which I kind of have a personal love for, was all the way online and still has some online events.
Well, those are great tips. Thanks so much for those. And we're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us in iambic pentameter at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, quick as a quatrain, clever as a couplet, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, poetry began as hymns of praise at funerals or before a battle. It was definitely a manly thing, but tolerated by women who'd maybe change the tune to a lullaby to get the kids to sleep. All the kids would grow up with glory in their dreams, and that's how civilization was born. But the Iliad was a poem about an event long gone, long before the first telling. It was ancient before there was ancient Greece. And did the Trojan War even happen? Bitterness was already baked in. The Iliad has been a big deal for ages. Centuries after its creation, a famous poet, John Keats, even wrote a poem about a new translation of the Iliad. That's how big a deal it was. Looking into Chapman's Homer no longer has that kick, but Chapman wasn't alone. Alexander Pope took a stab at it. Dryden brushed up in his Greek and Latin, and Robert Fitzgerald brought some modern lingo into the telling. Do people still read the Iliad? Well, sure. They made a Brad Pitt movie out of it. Poets still read Homer, still learn dead languages, wrestle with all the forms of poetry, sonnets, villanelles, pantoons, ballads. They study rhetoric and tropery. They have PhDs in history. They make field trips to visit ancient documents. Poets used to hope for some duke to fund their history of Satan in verse. Nowadays, it's grants or university if you want to master terza rima madrigals. On the other hand, poetry itself has now broken loose from the forms of the past. It's either been tamed or made wilder as it slips in and out of the mainstream in the form of rock and roll, free verse, performance art, stand-up comedy, dirty jokes, limericks, group cheers, or even some of the hooey put up by the creatives on social media. You could say poetry slams have taken the Mickey out of art, but our new culture carries a Mickey all its own. We like to revisit old culture, see if we can squeeze out some relevance. A recent version of the Iliad focused on the love between Patroclus and Achilles. Another focused on the rage of Briseis against Achilles, who killed her husband and made her his slave. There was a famous performance piece made of the Trojan women back in the 1960s with an internationally diverse cast, invented language, and what we used to call movement, which is what dance becomes when hippies do it. Somewhere in the 20th century, the old verities went kerflooey. We stopped caring about poor Prince Hamlet and more about ourselves. Amid the horrors modern times brought us, we found the glory of self-pity. White guy culture began bringing minorities into the castle, now carved up to make affordable housing. Just as epic poetry about God and heroes gave way to sonnets about love, the anonymous voice gave way to the poet's voice, kind of like the broadcaster voice on radio. You could tell it was a poet by the self-importance, the subject matter, and the total lack of rhyme. Early poems were performed and probably changed with each telling, so the hero could have different outfits and tasty meals that the poet could vamp on before getting to the big showpiece battle, with swords and vindictive gods and fate and all that. Maybe a catalog of all the heroes who were there at the big battle, how they died, who among the gods hated them enough to have them killed or loved them enough to elevate them to glory. And then kill them. Early poetry bridged a gap between history, myth, and lies. It was a legend, but the Greeks seemed awful enough for it to be true. Raping and betraying and adulterating and murdering. Why would you even tell that story? What made you decide to finally write it down? We were horrible. We ground Troy into dust for no good reason. But we know we need those stories, and only poets can tell them. We can't keep coasting along on past glory. Pride needs shame for a partner. Otherwise, we're all just ghosts in a burning house. That's what poets know, and they should remind us of it from time to time, whether it's trying for pity and terror with a 5-volume epic poem, or trying to get a laugh with doggerel sharpied on a bathroom wall. The empires were real, the stories were lies, and the gods have been gone a long, long time. Good riddance on one level, but whose fault is it? That's right. Poetry. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
Well, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.